your guide to all the must-see events. Explore more at kqed.org/summerguide2024. The announcers and technical staff of KQED Radio are affiliated with the National Association of Broadcast Employees and Technicians, CWA Local 51 AFL-CIO. A warming trend coming up Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. We're going to see temperatures from the upper 60s to the upper 90s inland. I'm Sandy Althaus, and you're listening to member-supported KQED-FM San Francisco, KQEI-FM North Highlands.
Today on Code Switch, white American evangelicals and Israel.
Israel is not a political issue. Israel is a Bible issue.
We understand that the nation that God would bless would be the nation and people of Israel.
If you bless Israel, I will bless you. If you curse Israel, I will curse you.
A lot of Christian Zionism is informed by beliefs, but it also goes beyond that.
His message was that the role of the church was not to adjudicate who was guilty for the Civil War or to try to get reparations for African Americans. All of that stuff was politics and worldly. What the church was called to do was go to evangelize.
Then on Life Kit, strategies to help you navigate without a GPS.
As you're navigating somewhere, you know, just turn around and look at where you came from every so often so that you know how to get back.
That's coming up on Code Switch and Life Kit from NPR.
After this news.
Live from NPR News, I'm Dale Willman. Tens of thousands of Palestinians who fled the Jabala refugee camp after the Israeli military entered the area are now returning to see what's left of their homes. NPR's Hadil Al-Salchi reports, a warning, though, that this story contains graphic descriptions.
Amin Abed is from Jabalia, which saw some of the fiercest fighting during the war. He fled west with his family, and after weeks of displacement, it was time to go home. Back in Jabalia, he found his house was rubble, the windows and doors blown out, and the neighborhoods were terrifying. The corpses he saw on the street were charred, he says, being eaten by dogs. The Israeli military has been expanding its operations across Gaza and especially the south. And for months after it first withdrew from Jabalia, the Israeli military went back in last month, saying that Hamas had regrouped there. In that mission, it said that it had also recovered the bodies of 7 hostages from Jabalia taken by Hamas. Hadil Al-Shalchi, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
Firefighters are working to contain the Corral Fire near the town of Tracy in California. The first big California wildfire of the season started Saturday afternoon and forced families to evacuate as one home burned to the ground. KQED's Catherine Monahan reports.
Travis Curtis is sitting in a gas station parking lot with other evacuees. It's the last stop before a roadblock, and on the other side is whatever remains of his parents' house.
Now we're waiting to get clearance to be able to go in and, you know, basically rip off the Band-Aid and see how bad it is. But from what we've been told by other news crews who have seen the property, there's the foundation and that is it.
Police ordered over 200 households to evacuate Saturday. Curtis says his parents left with only their tortoise, 2 dogs, and a bag of clothes. They're hoping their insurance can arrange housing for them while they decide whether to rebuild. For NPR News, I'm Catherine Monahan in Tracy.
Police in Akron, Ohio are asking witnesses to that city's latest mass shooting to come forward. Police broke up a street party Saturday night, but the crowd later returned and shooting broke out early this morning.
The latest update we have is that of the 25 victims, at least 2 remain in critical condition this evening. In addition to several who have been admitted with injuries and the one individual who sadly passed away. Some victims were treated and released from the hospital, and the victims range in age from 19 to 43, with most of the victims in their 30s.
Acting Police Chief Brian Harding says no one was arrested after the shooting. Investigators found 2 handguns and more than 35 shell casings afterward at the scene. You're listening to NPR News. British researchers have developed a blood test to predict the likelihood of breast cancer recurring. Vicky Barker explains.
Scientists at the Institute of Cancer Research in London analyzed blood from 78 patients with different types of breast cancer. The new test correctly flagged a high risk of recurrence in all 11 of the patients whose cancer returned during the 5-year trial. All 60 women in whom the test did not find cancer DNA did not relapse, meaning there were no false negatives. Presenting their findings at the world's largest cancer conference in Chicago, the scientists caution that their research is still at an early stage, but it's a potential breakthrough that could help millions of people catch their recurring breast cancer early enough to successfully treat it. For NPR News, I'm Vicky Barker in London.
OPEC Plus oil producers have agreed to continue their steep production output cuts. The cuts are aimed at increasing prices. Oil prices have dropped despite the turmoil in the Middle East and the start of the summer travel season. Saudi Arabia in particular wants higher prices to support its plans to diversify its economy away from fossil fuel exports. Novak Djokovic beat Lorenzo Musetti early this morning after a 4.5-hour-long tennis match to move forward at the French Open tournament in Paris. On the women's side, defending champion Iga Swiatek swept her quarterfinals in just 40 minutes, defeating Anastasia Potapova. Coco Gauff, meanwhile, also advances. I'm Dale Willman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include FJC, a foundation of donor-advised funds, working to maximize the impact of charitable giving and to create customized philanthropic solutions. Learn more at fjc.org.
You're listening to Code Switch, the show about race and identity from NPR. I'm Gene Demby. And today on the show, we are starting in Jerusalem.
Hi, I'm Mike Huckabee. I've been coming to Israel since 1973, when I was all of 17 years old. But starting in 1981, I started bringing groups here.
Y'all remember Mike Huckabee. He used to be the governor of Arkansas. He ran for president a couple times. He's a media guy now, and one of his side hustles is that he leads these semi-regular tours in Israel for evangelical Christians like himself.
He is risen. That is the message we all need to never forget. To get information on our next trip to the land of the Bible, go to thegreatesttrip.com. Thegreatesttrip.com.
I'm sure it's very expensive to go on his tours. There's a high demand for them.
That voice you're hearing belongs to Daniel Hummel. Daniel is a fellow at the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
I also direct a research center near campus called the Lumen Center, and I'm a historian of American religion and American foreign policy.
Daniel did some of his research in Israel and interviewed people on these tours while he was there. He said there are literally hundreds of groups that run tours like this, and you know, whether they're led by Mike Huckabee or someone else, they tend to visit the same sites and hit on the same general themes. One of the most spectacular moments on the tour Huckabee leads, though, is when he takes the tourists to this place called Masada. It's this ancient fortress high on top of a mountain in the middle of the desert.
It's the site of a Jewish resistance movement, sort of massacre in the year 79 AD when the Jews are resisting Roman rule. And so there's really nothing having to do with Christian history here. This is about sort of Jewish history, Roman history. But one of the first things you do in a Mike Huckabee tour is you go to the top and you start singing a few hymns, including A Mighty Fortress Is Our God. It's sort of like thematically good to do it up there. But then he sort of tells everyone, like, consider this your home. Like, think about that you're being welcomed home here in Israel. And he's trying to get across that the Christian faith started in Israel, just like Judaism did. And he's trying to sort of reorient the Americans on his tour to think of not of America as their home, but Israel as their home.
Before October 7th, before the pandemic, the Israeli government says about 900,000 Americans visited Israel every year as tourists, about half of whom were Christian. And it's tough to get hard stats on this part, but we know a big chunk of those visitors are evangelicals. They're on religious tours.
These tours are not sort of like centrally organized. There are literally thousands of tourist groups that go to Israel from the American Christian community. This is basically the same format of touring that's been around since the 67 war, which made a lot of these territories administered by Israel.
Daniel Hummel said that for decades, these tours have tended to be extremely curated, and the people who organize them are really careful about which parts of Israel they expose people to.
What these tours tend to avoid are the West Bank, except for some particular sites like the Church of the Nativity, because it has resonance for Christians, because that's the site of Jesus' birth. But they tend to avoid areas that would be under the Palestinian Authority or under related authority. This is not the vision of the Holy Land that most Christians have when they come to Israel. And it's not the vision that they're really interested in learning more about.
It's a viewpoint Mike Huckabee gave voice to when speaking to the press on a 2017 trip to Maale Adumim. It's a settlement in the West Bank considered illegal under international law.
There are certain words I refuse to use. There is no such thing as a West Bank. It's Judea and Samaria. There's no such thing as a settlement. They're communities, they're neighborhoods, they're cities. There's no such thing as an occupation.
These kinds of trips, similar to Birthright for young Jewish people, are a small part of why so many evangelical Christians in the United States are also Zionists, staunch supporters of the state of Israel. And that evangelical support has huge consequences for the United States' relationship to Israel as a whole.
Israel is not a political issue. Israel is a Bible issue.
No one can destroy what God has blessed. And make no mistake, God has blessed Israel.
So that's what we're getting into in this episode. How evangelical Christians have shaped U.S. support for Israel and how the idea of Israel has shaped the politics of evangelical Christians. We are in the eighth month of Israel's bombardment of Gaza. More than 34,000 people have been killed since Israel responded to Hamas's attacks on Israeli citizens on October 7th. And so stateside, people have been paying a lot of attention to how American Jews feel about Israel's bombing of Gaza. Some attention has been paid to the way American Palestinians and American Muslims think about it. Not enough. But when we talk about that region, American Christians, particularly evangelical Christians, they tend to be overlooked. That's likely because it's not as quickly named that Christians have an ethno-religious stake in the fate of that region, which is a mistake because their political support for Israel is a major driver for U.S. policy in that region. It's not the only driver, of course. Support for Israel has long been bipartisan and driven by a lot of factors. The United States routinely gives more foreign aid to Israel than it does to any other country, and almost all of that aid goes to Israel's military, about $3.3 billion a year. Since the attacks on October 7th, tourism to Israel is down, but some evangelicals are still traveling to Israel. Many of them are doing volunteer work to support Israelis, helping with things like orchard harvests or cooking meals for the Israeli military. And we've seen some distinctly Bible-y language being used in Washington by lawmakers. Take this moment when administrators of Columbia University were called before Congress so they could testify about how they were handling student protests on campus. This is Congressman Rick Allen questioning Columbia's president, Manu Shafiq.
If you bless Israel, I will bless you. If you curse Israel, I will curse you.
I have heard that. Now that you've explained it, yes, so I have heard that
it's
before.
It's now familiar. Do you consider that a serious issue? I mean, do you want Columbia University to be cursed by God of the Bible?
Definitely not.
Okay. Well, that's good. So here's the deal.
This perspective is not limited to individual politicians. Take Christians United for Israel. That's the country's largest Christian Zionist organization.
CUFI supports Israel because God supports Israel, and his word commands believers to bless, pray, comfort, and defend Israel and the Jewish people. For
Zion... They've been fundraising for Israeli settlement projects for decades, and they've been leaning on lawmakers in Washington, especially Republican lawmakers, to give more military and financial support to Israel as it continues to bomb Gaza. Christians United for Israel say they have 10 million members in the United States. Just to put that in perspective, there are about 7.5 million Jews in the United States. So even if every Jewish person in this country was a Zionist, and as we've talked about recently on the show, that is definitely not the case, then they would still be outnumbered by just this one Christian Zionist organization. I was looking for a breakdown of what the white evangelical landscape even looks like, so I reached out to our play cousin, Robert P. Jones. He's been on Code Switch a grip of times over the years.
I am a religion scholar. I am the president and founder at Public Religion Research Institute.
Robert said that the share of white evangelicals in the United States has fallen since 2000. Back then, about a quarter of the country identified as white evangelical. As a group, they're getting older and fewer young people are identifying as such. And those young people say that's in no small part because of social issues, particularly how churches treat LGBTQ folks.
Other people cited things being too partisan, which is something with the rise of the Christian right in the last few decades, and it being sort of not just political, but partisan, right? The overwhelmingly Republican has been a turnoff for many young people as well.
So today, the share of the population that is white evangelicals is about 14% and holding steady. That's still more than 47 million people in this country. Again, just to put that into perspective, only about 2% of the American population is Jewish and about 1% is Muslim. I had assumed that there were way more white evangelicals than that, just given how much sway they hold in our politics. But Robert said that's because they punch way above their weight in elections. They really turn out to the polls, and they're overwhelmingly clustered into one party.
Even though it's only 14% of the population, it makes up about a third of the Republican Party base.
All that gives them a very big megaphone. For a lot of evangelicals, their investment in Israel is of spiritual importance, informed by Israel's role in the Bible. So I think we kind of got to talk about those biblical ideas and what they portend for a minute. One of the flashiest versions of this idea is tied up with the end of the world. You might know the Left Behind series of books. They were New York Times bestsellers. They also became movies in the early 2000s. The inciting event in those stories is the rapture. This moment when, according to one reading of the Bible, all the Christian believers in the world will one day disappear in the blink of an eye.
People are missing. Dozens of seats are empty.
What's going on, Captain?
It's written in the scriptures. I guarantee it.
About.
There's going to be these end times that are terrible, 7 years of global chaos, natural disasters and suffering, the rise of the Antichrist, Armageddon. Like, these are words that we've heard right in our culture.
And this period of tribulation will last until Christ returns with all of his believers to reign on earth for 1,000 years. And everybody on earth, regardless of their religion, either will claim Jesus as their Lord and Savior, or they will die very terribly. But in this is why Israel matters here for so many evangelicals. In this prophecy, the restoration of a Jewish state in Israel was one of the dominoes that needed to fall in order for Jesus to return.
This prophetic portrait paints the following sequence of event for the future. America and Europe become weakened and cannot respond to Israel in the time that Russia and the Arab invasion begins against Israel.
That's the founder of Christians United for Israel, John Hagee, preaching in 2006. As you can hear, there is a lot going on in this prophecy, and we can't get to it all here. Just to be clear, not all white evangelicals share this belief, but for a long time, a lot of the most influential evangelicals in the United States did. And this idea, as a result, has really spread and permeated the American Christian world. Here's Robert P. Jones again.
If you've been in pretty much any Protestant, certainly evangelical churches, for any amount of time, you're going to run across hymns that have the word Zion in it. And they're not referring to Israel or Jews in those hymns. They're referring to Christians as the inheritors of the ultimate promise. It gets transposed into this Christian key. Even the part of a Christian Zionism that has to do with Israel, you have to understand that at the end of the day, Jews bow their knee to Jesus, right? At the end of that vision.
This strand of Christian Zionism that is informed by this very particular reading of prophecy that we're talking about, it sits real close to the idea that America should be a nation for Christians only.
you know, and I use this word promised land, that America is a promised land, right? And you hear that all the time, you know, Manifest Destiny, City Set on a Hill, all of these kind of metaphors, and even America is a new Zion. I mean, that's rife through our cultural lexicon, right? And all of that is borrowed from a kind of Zionist idea, but with white Christians seeing themselves as the proper final inheritors of those promises and being the chosen people.
And Robert says it's important to ask who is not in this story.
And it's pretty clear that who's missing from that are Muslims.
And he says another big thing is this way of understanding that part of the world and its political actors is shaped more by religious belief than historical fact. He sees it as a dangerous approach to international politics.
It's disconnected from any understanding of geopolitics, you know, actual history, foreign policy, but solely based on this kind of mapping religious writings from 2,000 years ago directly onto the complex politics of modern nation states.
When we come back,
we now just sort of take for granted today that there are millions of evangelicals who really care about the issue of supporting Israel. That's a really recent development. That's probably in the last 30 years.
That's after the break. Stay with us. You're listening to Code Switch from NPR.
When Atlanta Philharmonic conductor Amy Wilson was diagnosed with a brain tumor, she fell just short of qualifying for insurance through Medicaid. Why hasn't Georgia expanded the program?
I feel like access to good, affordable health care should be a human right.
Voters like her will determine the presidential election. Our series, We the Voters, on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Morning edition from 2 a.m. till 9 a.m. And this week on the Right Nowish podcast, Miguel Bounce Perez's culture flows through his ink. Right Nowish talks with the artist about how childhood memories influence his murals and his tattoos. You can hear that conversation wherever you get your podcasts.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from BritBox, dedicated to helping people discover a world of British TV, including new original crime thriller After the Flood from the producers of Happy Valley, streaming at BritBox.com/NPR. From Angie, dedicated to helping homeowners find skilled pros to get their home projects done well, from everyday repairs to dream remodels. Reviews, pricing, and booking are at Angie.com or on the Angie app. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
You're listening to Code Switch, the show about race and identity from NPR. I'm Gene Demby. So we've been talking about white evangelicals and how they've had this outsized influence in America's politics, particularly America's politics around Israel. As we said earlier, white evangelicals in the U.S. make up about 14% of the population, but their influence goes much further than that. I wanted to understand the theology and the history of that theology that was shaping evangelical beliefs towards Israel and how all of that has played out over the years. So I started digging deeper with Daniel Hummel. Daniel is the religious historian we heard from earlier in this episode. For our purposes, conveniently, he's also the author of the book Covenant Brothers, Evangelicals, Jews, and U.S.-Israeli Relations. And he said that one of the things that's most important for us to understand is that for a long time, American evangelicals were firmly of the belief that religion and politics should not mix. That belief took on particular significance during the Civil War, when a lot of evangelical leaders were really concerned with the way that the war was dividing white people on the issue of slavery. And so these evangelical leaders were saying, look, it's not our job to worry about this. Let's stay out of it. Here's Daniel.
The most influential person to pick up this way of thinking about the church was Dwight Moody, who was the most important revivalist in the 19th century in America. This is sort of a dated reference now, but he was like the Billy Graham of the 20th century. He spoke in front of millions of people, crucially in both the North and the South. Hmm. And his message was this otherworldly church message, that the role of the church was not to adjudicate who was guilty for the Civil War or to try to get reparations for African Americans. All of that stuff was politics and worldly. What the church was called to do was go to evangelize in the United States, in North America, but also to evangelize the world. And that was Moody's big call. And this is the way that the theology that we now call dispensationalism really entered into the mainstream of evangelicalism in the United States, is it was through this global missions focus and the theology that underpinned that, that became for millions of evangelicals just the sort of standard theology.
All right, a quick explanatory comma about a term you just heard Daniel use. Dispensationalism is a way of reading the Bible that includes the idea that Jesus could come back at any moment. And as Daniel said, the people who believe this believe that that's why they shouldn't concern themselves with the politics of the day. They're on a cosmic timeline. So then, how did this group become so concerned with the basket of thorny political issues that is Israel-Palestine?
Right. It's a complicated story that takes place over a century, and so there's a lot of change over that time. But for these earlier evangelicals, people like Dwight Moody, they were very interested in the Zionist movement. So the Zionist movement dates back to the 19th century. We start seeing the waves of Zionist settlers in the 1890s and after. And so they were interested in that, but they really saw it as something that they didn't have to participate in personally. This was something that God was orchestrating. God would ultimately make sure it would happen. And their role was to focus in on evangelization and other things. And it still takes a while, but by the 1960s, there's a growing group of evangelicals who, because of their prophecy beliefs, because of their humanitarian concerns, and because of a broader shift in evangelicalism to become more politically active on all types of issues, these things combine together in the 60s to start creating the modern Christian Zionist movement that we now just sort of take for granted today, that there are millions of evangelicals who really care about the issue of supporting Israel. That's a really recent development. That's probably in the last 30 years, you could say that that's a actually significant, consistent voting block, or not even a voting block, but just an issue block. Mm-hmm. But it took a long time, and it took a lot of things to fall into place for that to become natural to evangelicals, to think that political support for Israel was part of what it meant to be a true Christian or a mature Christian.
You mentioned Billy Graham. You said there was a data reference. In your book, you talk about Billy Graham as being, you know, part of this wave of evangelical leaders who played a big role in the tying together of this idea of like American Christians and their obligations to the state of Israel.
Right. And I just say it's dated because Graham's passed away now.
Evangelical Christians especially have an affinity for the Jews because the Bible they love is essentially a Jewish book written under the influence of God's Spirit. It is my conviction that the vast majority of evangelical Christians in this country and abroad support the state of Israel's right to existence. In biblical history and secular history, Israel has every right to exist as much as Syria or Egypt or Russia or the United States.
Graham and this other guy, G. Douglas Young, who's much less well known because he was much more focused on this one issue of evangelical support for Israel. You know, they were born in the 1910s, and so they came of age during the 20s and 30s. And so their imagination very much formed around World War II and the Holocaust. And so they were both trying to navigate sort of how to relate to Jews in the United States and also how to deal with this new entity on the international scene, the State of Israel, and what all this meant theologically. And so both Graham and Young, they both grew up in dispensationalist type traditions where they were taught that the founding of Israel in 1948 was very significant, or would be significant. They were taught about the rapture and all that kind of stuff.
In the midst of Armageddon, God is going to intervene. Messiah will come and set up his kingdom. Till that glorious day, we're to work and we're to pray for the peace of Jerusalem.
But they really came to their views of Israel in a post-Holocaust context. And so both of them grappled pretty deeply with the role of evangelization to the Jews, which was a major issue for evangelicals. Even the ones that were the most pro-Israel tended to also have as a goal converting Jews to Christianity. And this was not something that most Jews took kindly to. And in fact, this often scuttled any possibility of a relationship because Jews always suspected that right behind any type of friendly attitude was this ulterior motive of converting them. Mm-hmm. And so Graham and Young were at the forefront of trying to rethink that theology in a way that held on to the evangelicals' sort of desire for evangelization and the universal applicability of the gospel. And both of them made that turn. Young made it earlier. He made it in the 1960s. Graham made it in the 1970s. But these were really big moments where, particularly Billy Graham in 1973, comes out and basically says, it is not the role of Christians to try to convert Jews to Christianity.
When I preached, I spoke all over Israel. I told them that I had not come to proselyte. I'd come to thank them for proselyting me.
This creates some flack for Graham within the evangelical world, but he makes this turn, and it becomes something that today, if you're in any Christian Zionist setting, this is basically a given, that if you're supporting Israel as an evangelical Christian, you are not also trying to evangelize them. That would be head spinning to the 19th century dispensationalists.
In the late 1970s, Jimmy Carter was elected president, and Carter was famously a born-again Christian. And Carter suggested in one of his autobiographies that his biblical beliefs had shaped his approach to the Camp David Accords, this historic peace agreement that eased tensions between Israel and Egypt. And Carter was a Democrat, but more people with dispensationalist beliefs jumped into the fray of Middle East geopolitics once Carter's Republican successor in the White House, Ronald Reagan, took office. It always comes back to Ronald Reagan on the show, right? Anyway, here's Daniel again.
Yeah, this is a hard thing to square. So we have dispensationalists in the 1870s saying, don't get involved in politics because the church is meant only for heaven and for spiritual things. And then by the 1970s, we have almost the opposite. We have dispensationalists saying, you better get involved in politics because everything's going to sort of fall apart if we don't. And the way I try to square that is to say that their theology didn't really change. When you go to someone like Jerry Falwell, who becomes a major figure in the Christian right in the Reagan years and is a dispensationalist.
Bring you Jerry Falwell and the Old Time Gospel Hour.
He's not saying that the church has any other destiny besides evangelizing people, and for him, supporting Israel. Actually, that's one of the things. So he doesn't move much from that. But what changes is the analysis of the situation on the ground. And so in the 1870s, during Reconstruction, the view was that racial reconciliation, social justice, racial justice, these things were basically threats to the evangelization movement.
Why was that?
These things divided white people. These are things where Northerners and Southerners lobbed accusations at each other. Dwight Moody personally abhorred racism, abhorred slavery.
Dwight Moody, you'll remember, was an influential evangelical leader during the Civil War.
He actually protested against the Fugitive Slaves Act in 1850, but he did not prioritize that issue after the Civil War over other issues he cared about, like evangelization. And so he was willing to work alongside segregationists and supporters of Jim Crow if it meant getting evangelization further into the globe. It was to say, whether you're from Alabama or from Illinois, if you're a Christian, you care about getting the gospel out. So let's put all that stuff aside and let's unite over evangelization. I think by the 1970s, you have that same dynamic working, except it's sort of reversed in the sense that someone like Falwell is saying the biggest threat to evangelization is this thing called secular humanism, which he thought was taking over all parts of American society. And this comes out of a critique of the radical 60s that basically it was anti-Christian and feminism and LGBTQ movement in its infancy. All those things were sort of eroding the ability of the church in the United States to act independently, autonomously, to fulfill its mission to evangelize to the world.
I believe that we have, during the 1980s, a responsibility to our nation and to the free world to raise up a standard of righteousness which, if this nation is to be spared, if this nation is to survive, we must have a moral reformation.
And so he tries to gather other evangelicals, dispensationalists, who have a similar read of the situation and say, basically, for the sake of our greater calling of evangelization, we have to, in the short term, get involved in politics in order to protect our interests, our values on these things. And so for Falwell, those issues are, as he states them, feminism and abortion are the ones that he sees as basically existential threats. There's plenty of historians who've looked back and said race relations is also a major motivating factor for Falwell, though he tended not to cite that himself. But he increasingly took actions to build autonomous schools and other things in order to avoid integration rules in Virginia. He sees this all as sort of part of a larger conspiracy, foisting these values on On the Moral Majority, as he called his organization. So Falwell gets alongside a lot of other dispensationalist evangelicals. And so by the 1980s, a major segment of the Christian right, of the supporters of Ronald Reagan, are coming out of this motivation that they see this looming threat that's seemingly taking over education, media, government, everything else, and that they're going to vote to get Christians into those places to counteract that threat.
So what happened that white evangelicals went from, you know, reluctantly engaging in politics to keep the state off their backs and out of their business to becoming central to how they understood and moved through the world?
Well, there's two things probably. One is there's mission creep. So people make this argument for why they get into politics. Then they get into politics and they like being in politics and then they want to stay in politics. And there's definitely a version of that for the Christian right, that once people like Jerry Falwell got into politics, it actually was quite beneficial for him personally. So he ends up basically extending that window of when Christians need to get into politics to as long as he's alive, at least, and then after. So there is that. I mean, that's maybe a basic human trait, or at least one that's shared by a lot of these evangelical leaders. But I think a more profound one is that the Seven Mountains theology, or the Dominionist theology, or the theonomy, I mean, these are all terms to talk about like a Christian-run government. That's the du jour theology that's in the air right now among some on the Christian right. Evangelicals like James Dobson, the Focus on the Family founder, he comes from a different tradition, and he was willing to sort of work alongside Jerry Falwell and others when it made sense, but he also has a different theology that's animating what he's doing. And so by the 2010s, by today, there's an entirely different wave of conservative evangelical activism that comes much more out of the Pentecostal world, that comes out of the charismatic tradition. They don't think Jesus is going to come back to establish the kingdom. They tend to think Jesus has called Christians to actually establish that kingdom, that it is actually the role of the church to assume the seven mountains of culture. That's where that term comes from. So like media, government, business, there's like seven mountains. And their theology is Christians should be at the head of all seven of those, that is what God has called the church to do. That is a way different theology than Jerry Falwell ever taught, even though in many ways they can all vote for Republicans and that sort of gets what they want across. But in terms of their ultimate visions for how society should be ordered and what a Christian is called to do in that, they're very different.
What is their general sort of posture orientation towards Israel? Is it pretty consistent with the dispensationalist orientation to Israel?
They tend to be pro-Israel. They tend to be pro-Israel for slightly different reasons, though. So there's been a very popular move, I'd say in the last 30 or 40 years, to tie support for Israel to prosperity theology and basically say God wants to bless you to the extent that you bless Israel.
Huh.
Biblically, it comes out of a reading of Genesis 12:3, which is where God is speaking to Abraham, and he is saying, I will bless those who bless you and curse those who curse you. Basically, if you bless Abraham and his offspring, that's a stand-in for Israel, for the Jewish people.
He said, I will bless them that bless thee. One of the reasons for America's greatness is because we have blessed the Jew. We've blessed Israel.
One interesting side note to this is we often think of Christian Zionism as an American phenomenon. And it does, the dispensationalist part of it at least has a very American flavor to it.
Mm-hmm.
But today there are Christian Zionists all over the globe. In fact, if you got them all together, there'd be way more Christian Zionists in the global South than there would be in North America. And for those Christian Zionists, this blessing theology is absolutely at the core of why they support Israel. They are from developing countries like Brazil or South Africa or Nigeria, where the appeal of God materially blessing their country if they bless Israel has some like real meat to it, because they're actually trying to develop their countries in the moment. And one really practical way I saw this, I interviewed a South African politician. He's black, but he is a very strong Christian Zionist. And I was talking to him about why he supported Christian Zionism. And he cited this Genesis 12:3 reason. But it was really practical to him. He actually talked about a technology, agricultural irrigation technology, that Israel had gifted to South Africa in recent years.
Huh.
Israel's a very prominent exporter of farming technology to African countries. This is part of their diplomacy. And he said that that gifting of that technology was God actually fulfilling the blessing. It wasn't some vague blessing. It was the blessing of this technology. And the technology came to South Africans only through this relationship that South Africa diplomatically had built with Israel over the previous decade. So that's where it's like a really tangible blessing. It's not just this sort of like
wow,
pie in the sky, like, oh, you'll feel better, or somewhere in the future something good will happen to you. It's like, there are things here and now that they see as manifestations of that blessing. And that's really the logic that makes the global Christian Zionist movement run. And it's also very popular in the American scene as well. This works at an individual level, that you individually will be blessed, but also that your nation or your people group will be blessed in a way that is totally tied into how you're treating Israel and the Jewish people.
Daniel Hummel is a research fellow at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's also director of the Lumen Center for the Study of Christianity and Culture. And that is our show. But coming up right now on Life Kit,
strategies to help you navigate without a GPS.
As you're navigating somewhere, you know, just turn around and look at where you came from every so often so that you know how to get back.
This episode was produced by Jess Kung. It was edited by Leah Donella, and our engineer was Gilly Moon. Special thanks to Johannes Derge. As for me, I'm Gene Demby. Be easy, y'all. You are listening to NPR.
Hey, it's Francis Lam, host of The Splendid Table. Buying and cooking seafood at home can be intimidating for a lot of people, but we've got just the fix for that. And no, you don't have to start by making friends with a fishmonger. It's coming up on The Splendid Table.
The Splendid Table, up next at 10 o'clock. At 11 o'clock, news from the BBC.
With journalists located all around the world, the BBC World Service can cover international stories when they happen, wherever they happen. Global news you can trust from the BBC World Service.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy and helping clients find balance. Clients are matched with one of 35,000 therapists for online therapy from anywhere at betterhelp.com/public. From Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
You're listening to Life Kit from NPR.
Hey, what's up, everyone? Andrew Limbong here, in for Mario Segura. The other day, I had to run an errand. It wasn't crazy far from where I live in Baltimore. It was just in a part of town I don't go to all that often. So I hopped into the car and performed that ritual I imagine a lot of us do. Before the seatbelts, before checking the mirrors, before even turning the car on.
All right, where am I going? Where is this place?
I plugged the address into my phone.
1021 Delaney Valley Road.
Put it on the little holder thingy on the dash, and then, and only then, off I went. It's a little ridiculous if you think about it. I was headed to a local college campus. It's not out of the way on some hidden back street. It's on a main strip. And there are a bunch of signs around it being like, the college campus is this way. And yet, though I would have loved to have spent this beautiful spring drive with the windows down, bumping Vampire Weekend uninterrupted in the whip, because I don't have a great sense of direction, I was at the mercy of Google Maps.
On North Calvert Street for half a mile.
Because without it, not only would I be lost, I'd also feel lost. And I know I'm not the only one.
One of the things we measure in our lab is whether people feel anxious if they suddenly find themselves lost or realize they've lost track of where they are.
That's Mary Hagerty, a cognitive psychologist at the University of California, Santa Barbara. She leads the spatial thinking lab there, where they study how we see and interpret ourselves and other objects in space. And one of the things they study there is this thing called spatial anxiety.
We just ask you about scenarios. You know, imagine, you know, you have to navigate to a part of town you've never been before. Do you feel anxious about that? Or maybe
yes.
You suddenly find, you know, you don't, you're not where you thought you were. You know, does that make you feel anxious? You know, so.
Absolutely.
And again.
Good news is there are steps we can take to help alleviate spatial anxiety and get a better sense of the world around us. Today on Life Kit, boosting your sense of direction. You know, if I ever find my way back home.
Where am I going?
Turn left toward Goucher Road, then make a U-turn.
There are two questions I want to head off before we get started. The first is, why bother? For those of us not navigationally blessed, does Google Maps get me to where I need to go? Yes. Do I usually have my phone on me at all times? Sure, usually. I threw this question at Ben Giro. He's an outdoors recreation specialist with Cleveland Metro Parks, where he helps kids from the city get used to the outdoors, which includes teaching them how to navigate. So obviously he gets this question a lot.
Well, I mean, I just quite deadpan just say, like, well, has your phone ever died, especially when you're outside? And if so, like, how do you get going? Do you just kind of guess and do you just sit down and cry? I don't know.
Hugo Spears is a professor of cognitive neuroscience at University College London, and his expertise is in spatial navigation. And he says that having a good sense of direction gives you more than the ability to just go from here to there.
My advice would be, yeah, don't stress yourself out, you know, trying to push yourself to navigate, but it's kind of try and find the fun in it, of the power you have over the environment.
Hugo's research includes looking at the brains of the people who drive the black taxis in London. Those are the people who have to take that pretty rigorous test covering about 25,000 street names in London.
The thing I discovered, London taxi drivers, once they've mastered these street names, they have some sort of real sense of ownership of the city. So I think there's a lot of value in how we connect to the environment that goes beyond just tapping into digital maps.
Okay, so that answers the first question of why. Now, what about who? Mary Hagerty from the Spatial Thinking Lab says there is some separation between people who are good at navigation and those of us who are bad at it.
I would say it comes from two things. I think probably a certain amount of it is inherited, but I think it's largely comes from the types of navigation experiences you've had in your life, you know, how much you have actually been challenged in navigation and how much you've challenged yourself.
And there is that old canard about how men have a better sense of direction than women, which there may be some differences in how men and women navigate, but the underlying reasoning is cultural, says Hugo, because in countries with higher gender equality, there is little gender difference in navigational skill.
So there are countries like much of the Scandinavian countries where there's no real difference between men and women. It's very small. And in school, they learn how to navigate. Whereas in various countries around the world where there are big gender discrepancies between what women and men can access for education, healthcare, travel, you see big differences in navigation skill.
And yes, there is still a lot we don't know about why some people are better at it than others. Like Mary said before, there are some people who just got it like that. But if that's not you, there are some things you can practice that'll teach you about your own neighborhood or that you can even apply if you're visiting somewhere. Here's Mary again.
I think of navigation as sort of a use it or lose it skill. You know, if you use it, you get better at it. So that's where I would start.
Okay, so let's start. Takeaway one, get lost on purpose. Here's outdoor specialist Ben Giro.
I would recommend that if you're not in a time crunch, just try taking a different turn and seeing where it ends up.
And yeah, while Ben's expertise is out there in the woods, he says in the context of a more urban area, to get a better sense of direction, it can be helpful to act like you're on a leisurely hike.
Next time you decide to go on a walk or go for a stroll, go down a road you've maybe not walked to and see where it ends up. Maybe walk the scenic way to your favorite bodega or your bar or where at coffee shop or whatever.
This is not the most efficient way to get from point A to point B, but that's sort of the point.
I think we've all gotten used to the idea of that, like, we gotta go, 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 get to our spot. We don't want to waste time. That, like, old adage of time is money, you know. When in some circumstances I can understand the need or the compulsion to try to get there as efficiently as possible. But I'm not an Uber Eats driver, so no one's waiting on my getting to a destination before their ice cream melts or their tacos get cold.
The philosophy still stands, even if you're driving from the highway to the burbs and back.
what's the harm in taking 5 minutes to 10 minutes longer to get back to the highway when you're going home from your friends or family's place? Probably nothing. So, you know, instead of putting on a GPS to get back to the highway, a little bit of adventure, a little bit of exploration, and just try to get from the burbs back to the highway, you know?
Well, let me ask you the opposite is, what is the benefit of taking the time to do that?
Well, so you're never just going to magically acquire a skill. So in order to learn a skill, you have to work at it. You have to practice it. You have to think about, you know, senses of directions and turning right and left and kind of keeping a sense of a direction in your head as you travel. When you have a GPS on, you're probably not thinking about any of that.
Just a quick note, we're not trying to make anti-GPS propaganda here. They can be a great tool. Mary says the most common use of GPS that people self-report isn't for turn-by-turn directions, it's to get accurate, up-to-date traffic information. But she says an over-reliance on GPS can lead to, literally, a more narrow view of the world.
If you're just looking at your GPS, you're not paying attention to the broader environment that maybe, you know, gives you cues of, okay, this, you know, when this is on my right, it means I'm here. And when this is on my left, it means I'm here. That is one of the big pieces of advice I would give to people is, you know, try navigating without it, especially for routes that you take pretty frequently. And, you know, pay attention to the cues in the environment that help you stay oriented on those routes.
Which brings us to takeaway two, pick out a few big landmarks that you can use to orient yourself. These landmarks can come in different genres. Like, sure, you can use the fourth wave coffee shop down the block or the gas station with the good snacks as street level landmarks, but the most helpful are the massive far away ones.
The most useful landmarks are distal landmarks, landmarks that are far away, right? Because like, so say something like the bank on the corner, that might be a landmark that helps you turn right. If you know you have to turn right on the bank to go to a certain place, but you know you're coming up to the bank, it's on your right, and then after you've turned, it's behind you. You know, so its relation to you changes as you navigate. But something that's in the distance, like for us in the mountains, you know, it's something that's always far away. So it's a better cue to orientation.
And Ben says this is something humans have been doing for centuries. You know, picking a thing and having that be the so-called true direction for you.
I know the more flat it is, the harder it is, but growing up in Cleveland area, we have Lake Erie is always north. So I like to say just try and find one thing to be your true direction.
It can be a tall building or a big sign, but it can also be a major highway.
A lot of highways go north-south. Sometimes they're diagonals, but you know, maybe knowing, what's it, 395, I think, goes from Baltimore down to D.C.
295, yeah.
295. So that's like a big north-south. So if you're south of Baltimore and you can like see that major highway or know that you're near it and kind of remember the last time you turned, those kind of things help.
If you do end up lost, these landmarks can help guide you. If not where you need to be, somewhere more familiar to you. It helps if the landmarks are distinct. It also helps if you've got a personal relationship to them. Here's Hugo.
There are certain chemicals running through in your like natural endogenous chemicals in your brain that kind of lock in memories. So things like dopamine is this well-known molecule we get when we get rewarded by something. So if you're in an experience like that where, wow, lots of great things around you, things have happened, you've got this really positive memory, then your brain has got more flexibility to hold on to some of those memories is the way that the research suggests.
And this is something we can take advantage of. Takeaway three, turn your environment into a narrative that you can understand.
That is indeed what a lot of expert navigators do, is use narratives to help lock things in. Because like I said earlier, it's great if you can memorize street names, but street names are often like completely abstract. So the tricks people use are to turn these street names into stories and use whatever tricks, you know, personal stories you can make up.
It's one thing to say, oh, that's 12th Street. It's another thing to say, oh, that's 12th Street, where my buddy and I walked up to get those churros that one day.
Key to good memory is often like how deep you're able to get that information in. So are you just like glancing at a street, or are you looking at it thinking, that doesn't make sense. Why is that here? And what's going on? Oh, there's something happening. The more you focus on the detail and things and think about it more deeply, the more like you are to form a memory of it that lasts.
To go back to an earlier example, when Ben mentioned 295, the route that connects Baltimore into Washington, D.C., those numbers, 295, they don't mean anything to me. I just know it as the highway I take when I have to drive into the main NPR offices in D.C. This process of connecting these ideas is called building a cognitive map.
So not literally kind of being able to see a map, but just having an idea of where things are and how they're all connected. And that's used when you're sort of navigating somewhere you've recently been, you're just learning around, or maybe you've been there for some time, but you're having to really think about how different places are connected.
And you can help get more experience building this map by being the decision maker, says Mary.
If you're the decision maker, you know, making the decisions to turn right and turn left, you know, so the actively exploring your environment is better than just, say, being the passenger where, you know, you are experiencing the same route as the driver, but you're not making the decisions.
Hugo says pay extra attention to the intersections.
What you need to do is pay a little more attention to the way the junctions are laid out and think, okay, if we go into that junction, it's not actually straight ahead. It's slightly to the right.
Also, the streets themselves can lay out a story for you. Here's Ben.
Most inner city grids have some semblance of streets and avenues where they're numbered going one direction. And then this is where every city typically does it a little different. I lived in a city in Ogden, Utah, and they did presidents. So it was like, instead of first, it was like Washington.
Which, even if you don't know your presidents down pat, you have a general idea of where you are.
So like you'll hit some president and be like, oh, well, Kennedy, that's way later. So I'm in the wrong part of town. That's kind of like knowing your city, knowing which ones are the north-south, which ones are the east-west, and you can follow those.
The next takeaway, takeaway 4, is probably one of the simplest, which is, as you travel in your day-to-day life, just look back. Literally, look behind you.
As you're navigating somewhere, you know, just turn around and look at where you came from every so often so that you know how to get back. I mean, that's something I use a lot while hiking. You know, I'm taking a particular path, you know, sort of looking around and saying, okay, this is what it looks like when I know I have to take the left path or something like that.
This works if you're going to a new place or if it's some restaurant you go to all the time.
If you just sort of walk to the restaurant without looking behind you or taking in the environment, you'll just have a very, like, this is the views I saw when I went there, not some sort of more holistic understanding of what the space looks like. So it just helps to be a bit more curious about the space around you and what it looks like from different viewpoints.
Be more curious about the space around you is probably the big overall takeaway from all of this, because we're not trying to be London cabbies, I assume. It's a matter of simply being more confident in the space around you, which helps you stay calm if you do ever get lost. At which point, just ask somebody. Okay, recap time. Takeaway 1, get lost on purpose. When you've got the time, turn off your GPS and figure out your way back home, or just walk around and explore a little. And while you do that, takeaway 2, pick out big landmarks to orient yourself. It helps if they're far away, also if they're distinct.
Outside my office window, I have a cylinder-type tower. It's used, like, I cannot tell looking at it which way I'm facing, because it looks the same from every direction. So that's an example of one that's not so useful.
It also helps if you've got a connection to those landmarks, which brings us to takeaway 3, use narratives to help make connections between landmarks and roads and places you frequent. All of this will help bolster these places in your memory. And takeaway 4, look back, turn around, see places from a different perspective, and you'll have a better sense of both where they and you are. This episode of Life Kit was produced by Claire Marie Snyder. Megan Kane is the supervising editor. Beth Donovan is the executive producer. Engineering support comes from Becky Brown. Special thanks to Pablo Fernandez-Velasco, Nora Newcomb, Margaret Tarampi, and Daniel Montella. I'm Andrew Limbaugh. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Life Kit from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Storyworth. Each week, Storyworth emails a loved one a question about their life. After a year, they'll publish family memories into a bound book to keep forever. Learn more at storyworth.com. From BritBox, dedicated to helping people discover a world of British TV, including new original crime thriller After the Flood from the producers of Happy Valley. Streaming at BritBox.com/NPR. And from ECMC Foundation,
at ecmcfoundation.org.
Some people wonder what it is that makes NPR's news coverage feel so personal. The answer's easy. We're talking to you. Listen weekday mornings to Morning Edition from NPR News.
You can listen weekday mornings, Morning Edition, from 2 a.m. till 9 a.m. Stay connected, stay updated. Follow KQED News on social media for immediate alerts and stories. Speaking of stories, we are heading into a heat wave as we get into the middle of the week. Tomorrow's highs from the low 60s to the upper 70s. Then on Tuesday, though, we're going to see temperatures rise to the mid-60s and low 90s. Walnut Creek on Tuesday, 94. But tomorrow in Walnut Creek, the high should only reach 74 degrees. 66 tomorrow for the high in San Francisco. I'm Sandy Althaus, and you're listening to KQED-FM San Francisco and to KQEI-FM North Highlands, Sacramento. 10 o'clock.
It's the Splendid Table from American Public Media.